Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Welcome to Text Message. I'm Nate Langson.
And I'm Ian Morris.
And we are starting this show by not talking about the recently released glass oblong that is the iPhone 6S. Although, don't worry, oblong lovers, we will be coming back to that in our review, which is what's going to take up most of the show this week. Ian and I both in possession of iPhone 6Ss, and we're going to discuss that in a bit. But first, a related piece of UK technology news, which is that Vodafone is going to allow Wi-Fi calling with a bunch of phones on its network from the iPhone 5S, I think, or 6 upwards, and some Androids as well. Now, this is a pretty interesting piece of technology because it's allowing you to use your phone's Wi-Fi signal exactly as if it was a cellular signal. No apps needed, no configuration on your device's part. Basically, if your phone detects that it is low or has absolutely no signal whatsoever, but you're connected to Wi-Fi, it will use your Wi-Fi instead for calls and texts. Ian, that's accurate so far,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Now, the reason this is relevant this week is because Vodafone has announced this, and it's now another network that offers the feature, which is actually a fairly new technology, at least in the UK, EE being the first company to allow it. Now, there are a couple of things that I find interesting about this. The first one is that it's not something that's been made available before, which, frankly, I think is a little bit baffling now I think about the history. This would have saved a lot of 3's network congestion, I believe, at least on my side of the phone subscription fence. But also, the other interesting thing is that on Vodafone and EE, I believe, the inclusive calling comes out of your minutes. So it's effectively counting the minutes you spend on your Wi-Fi network as minutes you've spent on its cellular network. Does that strike you as peculiar, Ian?
It's annoying, isn't it? I mean, it annoyed me when I found out about it.
Most things annoy you when you find out about them, Chief.
That's true. But fortunately, I was able to give it a little bit of thought. And I have had conversations with other people like EE before about Wi-Fi calling. And whilst it on the surface is extremely irritating, I think it's got a lot to do with the fact that when you do make a Wi-Fi call, for security reasons and to make sure that the network, you know, is treating your call as if it was any other call, it has to pass it through the usual system. So it goes through the billing system. So that's the point, I think, is really that, I mean, as annoying as it sounds for you to be filling in the holes of another network and then paying for it, essentially, but with your own call minutes, I think the point is it would actually be very difficult for them to do it any other way. I don't think they could do it any other way. Because basically, once it's on their network as a call, it just appears like any other call.
Well, that is very interesting. I genuinely did not know that. However, I've also got a comeback to my own argument. Would you like to hear it?
I would love to hear it.
Here it goes. I contacted Vodafone because I thought this was bizarre. They sent me the press release about this Wi-Fi calling feature, and I saw the note about how it comes out of your inclusive minutes, and I emailed Vodafone's spokesperson, and I said, WTF. I used a sentence, not just a single acronym. a spokesperson replied and gave me what I actually think was a very fair answer, and also one that completely gets around the point. It's thus: Wi-Fi calling is only available on Red Value price plans with compatible devices. All Red Value price plans come with unlimited minutes and would therefore not affect your minute allowance. So what they've actually done here is launch a feature that causes people like you and I to raise the question of, why does this count against my minutes when I'm using my own network? And then said that, well, it doesn't matter because the minutes are unlimited anyway. So what's the point in pointing it out in the first place, thus causing A, this podcast section to exist, and B, the vexing feeling inside the minds of the customers to which you owe quite a great deal of gratitude?
Yeah, and also, why is Wi-Fi calling only available on the Red Value price plan?
Well, that I don't know, because I never got back to him on that point because I thought he's irrelevant for this conversation.
Well,
but I agree, this is an onion that I feel we have only begun to peel.
But ignoring all of that, okay, the fundamental problem with Wi-Fi calling is that they treat it like it's a bonus for the customer. What it is you're paying to fill in their shoddy network. Now, obviously,
no one can have complete service. I disagree on that completely, because there are many, many places where it is physically impossible for Vodafone or any network to penetrate with its signal thrust.
Not my house. It's not impossible for them to penetrate my house.
Maybe not a house, but if your house was, for example, in the basement of an ironclad building,
yes, fine.
Then you would not call Vodafone up and say, excuse me, but I want a refund on my contract.
Because I wouldn't call Vodafone at all, because I'm not a Vodafone customer and they'd think it's slightly weird if I did.
All right, well, let's say you were, and let's say you called them. You would only even be able to call them because they provided service via Wi-Fi into your ironclad Fort Knox-esque basement.
Seems fair.
So it does seem fair. Well, fairness also comes in the form of journalistic balance and integrity. And on that point, we should point out that Three and O2 offer not quite as feature-rich plans for Wi-Fi calling, but they do offer apps that allow you to use the Wi-Fi in your home or office or basement or prison to send calls and texts as if it was from your number. But really, that's a stopgap, and we should be expecting all networks to be offering Wi-Fi calling by, you know, well, now-ish, really. But it seems like a no-brainer for them all to start offering.
Well, it's a bit difficult, that's the problem, because unlike an app, it requires hardware support. So it's actually a little bit more difficult than just saying, oh, yeah, we're going to support that now, because you have to have, I mean, there's only very few phones that do it. The iPhone is one. The Samsung Galaxy S6 is the other, as another. So your phone base isn't massively flexible, although phones from providers tend to do it. So Vodafone's own handsets and EE's handsets will probably all do Wi-Fi calling.
That's true. And actually, it's probably worth noting that on, I think, Android and Windows phone, you have to get the phone from the carrier. You can't get an unlocked phone and put a SIM card from your carrier into it and have it work. It has to come from the manufacturer, or at least that's what they tell you.
Well, that can't be true.
I think it is. I think it is. I did do my research on this earlier, and I do remember that being pointed
Interesting.
Out. Well, let us know if you're using Wi-Fi calling on Vodafone or EE. Has it got you out of any trouble? Have you been in an ironclad basement and desperately needed to make a phone call or to send a text message? Let us know. podcast@natelangson.com. We'll review your use case scenarios next week. Now, we're going to come to some feedback later on in the show. We didn't have any last week. Well, we actually did have some, but we didn't get around to reading it out. And indeed, there was also one that I forgot we had. And fortunately, that listener wrote in again to point out my inept qualities as a host and resent his email. So we're going to get to all of those in a bit. But it is time to embark on our iPhone 6S review. So, Android lovers, iPhone haters, Apple haters, it's probably fair to say that if you would be annoyed by 10 minutes of discussion about an iPhone, this is your point to switch off and listen to something else.
The problem is, Nate, that you never get someone like that to switch off because of that. They're going to listen because they're going to get annoyed by it, surely.
Well, I don't mind that to an extent, as long as they write in with an argument, because then we can discuss it on next week's show, podcast@natelangson.com. That's where you can send your hate. Now, let's get going on this. I'm not going to go over reviewing the specs, because I don't want to do a disservice to our listeners' geekish tendencies, because I reckon you all know that it's an iPhone 6S. It's the incremental update to Apple's iPhone line. It is the talk to the tick that is the iPhone 6 and 7 and 8. And it has a 12-megapixel camera up from 8 megapixels. It does 4K video recording. I don't know why I'm going over these. I was basically making the argument that I'm not going to go over the features, and pretty much just did. It's a bump up to the internal specs and hardware, but the phone physically looks the same. Now, Ian, before we get onto any specifics of the phone's improvements, because I know we both have points to make, How have you found the phone to use? And has anything yet stood out to you and thought, I was either expecting to really like that, but I actually don't like it that much, or vice versa?
Well, I've only had it a day, to be honest. I got it earlier, and I've been playing with it quite extensively, managed to run the battery down. But obviously, when you get a new iPhone, there's quite a lot of waiting to be done, isn't there? Because you have to sync your backup, and I rely quite heavily on that because I've quite heavily customised the, you know, the folders and all that kind of stuff to keep me sane. But I've actually found the two big things, the 3D touch and the live photos. And I've actually played with both of those and really enjoyed them.
Okay, let's begin with the 3D touch,
yeah.
Because live photos is the main point that I wanted to discuss.
Cool.
So let's start with what will probably be the shorter discussion. 3D touch, this is the ability to press and hold the screen. And effectively, Apple, I don't know if Apple's described it as sort of like a right click for your phone, but certainly it's adding an additional way to interact with a single element on the phone. So it's rather than just tap or tap and hold. You can do all those, but you can also physically press, and it's an analog press. So there is an incremental amount of pressure that you can apply to the screen, and the screen detects that. So in some of the demos Apple's given, this has been things like, instead of tapping to open an app on your home screen, you sort of physically pinch, like squeeze one of the icons, and a contextual menu pops up. In the case of the camera, it allows you to take a front-facing narcissist photo, or or a rear-facing or a slow-mo. But what have you found that to be useful for so far, if at all?
Well, I have, because the apps will all support it. There's an API, so eventually everything will support it. And what I've done is I've had a little play with Instagram particularly, and I've done that because actually I don't like the Instagram app. I find it fairly difficult to use. And the nice thing about the 3D touch is that you can give that home icon a little hard press, and then you get a load of options. And actually, it's a really nice way of interacting with the app.
I agree. I'm doing it right now.
Well, actually, so am I. I'm going to Instagram a picture of my microphone and say I'm podcasting with you, because the good thing about it is that I find that navigating through apps can be a pain. And, you know, as I get older, I can't remember where anything is in the app. So,
mate,
you're
not that old.
Well, I know.
Jesus.
I know, but I've lost focus. That's the problem, I think. I just can't be bothered with the trivialities of remembering things anymore. I want to outsource my remembering to a computer, so that when I want to remember something, I just get the computer to tell me what to do. From my point of view, the few chances I've had to use it, email particularly, or obviously Apple's apps will support it, it's actually exactly what they promised, and it is the sort of thing you'd find yourself using. I'll give you a comparison.
Please do.
Because Samsung's got, obviously, with the Edge, and then the Edge Plus now. Both phones I absolutely love, but they've got the Edge thing where you can flick in and you can either call one of your favourite contacts or you can quick launch an app. But I never use it, and I think the reason I don't use it is that it somehow lacks logic for me. I don't know why. I suppose if you were just given the phone, immediately told about that feature and used it instantly from the start, then maybe it would sort of get ingrained in your brain. But the Apple thing, I think, is kind of almost... I think because I've used a PC for so long, I mean, it's a bit of an irony, that, isn't it? PCs have right-clicks and Apple and Macs don't. But because I'm very used to that right-click action, in my mind, this kind of feels a bit like that. So I'm thinking, well, I want to use an option, so that's a right-click for me. So that works. So perhaps PC users will enjoy using the iPhone more. There's a little scandalous idea for the world.
Although it's like slightly common misconception that Macs don't have a right click.
They do have
many
right.
years.
Well, they do, but it's not quite the same, is it?
Let's and they also have a two-finger click.
Well, they do. They have a lot of gestures and clicks and things, but that's not the point.
No, it isn't the point. But your main point before
yes.
the bit that wasn't wrong is you're absolutely right. It is that contextual action, but I'm finding so far that it's taking me a little bit of muscle memory to learn that it's a feature at all. And if anything, I'm slightly more vexed by the fact that not all the apps do it. For example, I'm pressing and holding on Tweetbot right now.
Yeah.
I don't get anything, but I'd like to get either an account switching option or a new tweet option or something. I'm force pressing BBC News. I'm not getting any headlines.
No.
I'm force pressing Pocket. I'm not getting any items that I saved to discuss on today's show. What else am I not getting? Let's see. MSN Messenger, not getting anything there. Skype, not getting anything there. So it's taking a while. And, you know, I'm not surprised. This is always the case. But I don't know, while I do like the idea, I don't believe that shortcuts from a home screen is a reason to love this technology. I can't help but feel that the real use for this hasn't yet been implemented. And I want to come up with a couple of suggestions for ways they could use.
Yeah.
Developers can make this better. Number one, better ways to send messages to people. I think you should be able to create rumble patterns with a phone by pressing and holding on the device and then sending a rumble message to someone. No idea what the use would be, but it feels like something that should exist.
Morse code?
Yeah. Next one, something in the camera app. And I'm thinking about things like some sort of progressive zoom or some sort of selective focus or maybe a way to apply the strength of a filter to a photo. The harder you press, the more intense.
Well, that's a good idea.
Maybe the contrast is or something like that. And you can sort of press and release with greater difficulty to sort of... Mm. You know, get a feel for where you want your photo to be.
Well, that's kind of like if you draw in the notes app, that's kind of like that works like that, doesn't it? Sort of, and you know, you can add pressure to the pen and reduce
yeah.
it. So that's a good point.
I think that could be quite useful. I think that it could be used quite nicely in maps so that, you know, you could either tap to drop a pin or press and hold to drop a pin and then immediately share it.
Yeah.
I think it's things like that that I'm keen to see developed more with this technology. But I do like it so far.
Well, we are at the very, very start, aren't we? I mean, you know, the phone is only just out. The API is new. People are
Definitely.
Learning it.
It's brand new. There's some items as well. Like, I'd like to be able to go into playlists and all right, I'll give it that. I didn't know it did that. I just tried it and it did. I pressed and held on an artist and it brought up the album list.
Oh, well, there you go.
As a peak preview, and then I clicked in and now I can listen to ABBA Gold.
Yeah.
I think right that, above also, Aborted in my library, which is something you don't see on many phones, I suppose.
No. Well, one thing I did find quite good about it was I didn't expect it to be quite as good as it is in terms of it feel, you know, you really are pushing through the screen, aren't you? It's kind of, you think it might be something you might do by accident, but actually you will never, ever do it by accident. It's completely impossible to trigger that by accident. You have to very deliberately push in. And again, the same with the next step. So with Peak and, what's it called?
Peak and Pop, sorry.
Well, with Peak and Pop, I thought that if perhaps you would end up popping it when you wanted a peak, but it doesn't work like that. And it actually is completely slick. So, you know, fair play to them. They've certainly thought about it and implemented it in a way that I think will be good, especially when app developers get on board.
I agree. I think that it's something that's quite alien to some hands to really physically press a screen. I do notice that the other day I was showing a colleague this. In fact, funnily enough, I was showing a colleague this before going on the telly at work to demonstrate this feature to said colleague. And before we actually went on live, she failed at it a couple of times until I said, no, you actually have to press it. And then she went, oh, right. And she got it and then carried on doing it. But it did take that little bit of time to get someone to actually say, you have to physically press the screen down. And it was just interesting that what I was about to show quite naturally to somebody on the TV, they did actually need a little bit of, not coaching for, but just a little bit of extra prodding in terms of how to do it. So I thought that was quite interesting. It'll take some muscle memory there. So anyway, that is the pressing the screen hard feature. Let's talk about one of the other features, which is the photos move without you touching them feature, also known as live photos. Now, a live photo has been described in a couple of ways. On one hand, on the more excited hand, it's been described as that thing in Harry Potter where the pictures in the newspapers move. And on the other, slightly more cynical hand, it's been described as a bit like a video, but not as good. I'm a little closer to the former in terms of excitement. This is a feature that when you take a photo, the phone remembers or records, which is a digital memory, it records 1 second before the picture that you want to take, the frame that you want to take, and 1 second afterwards. The effect is that you can force touch, whatever the goodness we're calling
3D
it.
3D touch.
Yeah, 3D touch, press, peak, I guess. And then the video sort of plays. It's kind of a low frame rate, but very sort of smooth, almost like a GIF, actually, video of the 2 seconds. So the frame that is the photograph is actually the very middle frame in this 2 second little scene. And it's very, very effective. And the other thing, and if anything, I actually find this even more fun and useful, is as you've taken a load of these live photos, let's say you've taken 50 odd photos, which I did at a wedding at the weekend, for a friend's wedding, as you scroll through them naturally, just swiping the photos from left to right, it plays the first second, if you like, as you scroll past them. So it stops on the frame that is the photograph. So as you're scrolling through, it's just literally just a split second. It must be a quarter of a second of movement of the photo. And it really makes a very, very interesting difference to how you browse through a photo, because you just get that little bit of extra contextual information beforehand. And it's really, really difficult to describe, other than if you can imagine, as the photo slides into view, the split second of activity in that photo, just as you press the button, is physically moving as the photo slides into view. It's like that. So it just gives this extra level of movement and memory to the picture. And I thought this was really amazing. And I actually said, when I went in last week for my sort of demo, if you like, with Apple to go with a phone, and I said to them at the time, I was like, I don't know if you've heard this yet already, but I think this scrolling through feature is actually more exciting than the actual live photo itself, where you are pressing and holding to get the activity. I actually really like the way now that as I was swiping through all these wedding photos, I loved how there was that little bit of extra movement for every single photo as I'm swiping through. And a lot of these sorts of features we use, and we turn them off and on depending on the use. I don't think I'll ever turn this off. Certainly not unless I know I'm taking loads and loads of photos, of which I only want one of. If I'm going away for a weekend or out for an evening, I'm absolutely going to shoot all of them on this live photo mode, because it is a much nicer experience when you're swiping through. And the other thing that I noticed is that while you can't press and hold the photos on the iPad currently to activate the live view, the actual 2 second animated bit, as you're swiping through them, it does display that little bit of pre-photo motion as you're swiping through the gallery. So it's, whether I'm using it on the iPad or on the phone, I haven't checked it on the Mac, actually, on El Capitan, but I believe it's supported on that too.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, it's adding this extra little bit of memory to the photo. But yeah, if you share the photo, it's just sharing a normal JPEG. So I'm a big fan of this, and I have to say that it's probably my favorite feature of all of them. That, and the fact that the camera quality is a lot better, not necessarily when you're looking at it on the screen, but when you're zooming in or looking at it on a larger screen, particularly if there are a lot of small objects or a lot of people or different shapes and colors in the picture, you can definitely tell that the camera quality has improved, because the resolution is higher, but the detail, at a full crop is about the same as it was before. So you're getting a lot more for your money, and not just additional file size of blur.
Yeah, absolutely. Like.
So that's a little bit of a monologue there, but I have to say, it's generally speaking, I find that the S release in an iPhone cycle, is less exciting. I was never really that bothered about Siri. I haven't used it that much. The Touch ID is cool, but not something I got super excited about. live photos and the better camera and the 4K video recording, honestly, it's really good. I normally don't find myself saying to people that the year-to-year upgrade from a 6 to a 6 Plus in this case, a 6 to 6S in this case, rather, is worth the upgrade. But if you really value photos and video, and you like the having a lot of gallery collections that you do browse through all the time, I actually have to say, I think this is one of the few times that I would recommend someone upgrading from last year's model to the current year's model. I really, really do.
Well, to give you an idea of just exactly how good live photos are, I've only taken one. Well, actually, I have taken some since. So the first one I took was of my daughter, and it worked so perfectly that I immediately set it as my, you know, my unlock screen thing, because it's kind of nice, and that doesn't affect the rest of the phone. And it just looks beautiful. It's really good. So as long as you've got the right kind of material, you know, kids are good, pets are good, that kind of stuff.
You know what, mate? I mean, you're saying this. I haven't even tried that yet.
Yeah,
I haven't even tried that. Okay, let me find one of my girlfriend. There's one. There's one of her.
Okay. Well, of course, the other thing is, and this is we actually haven't discussed this, and we should. So while you're doing that, let me talk about the Touch ID, because they've improved it to the extent that it is so ridiculously fast to get into it now that you don't actually see the home screen very much. So because if you unlock your phone from the Touch ID button, it is simply enough to just touch it very lightly for almost a second, and it just lets you in. It's incredible. But of course, if you want to see it, you could just use the power button on the side, so it's not the end of the world. But that is extremely useful, having faster Touch ID.
Well, I have to say, I completely agree on the Touch ID front, but this bit of extra animation on my lock screen, I haven't even tried that until we're literally recording right now. And actually, it doesn't seem to work. Oh, it does. Oh, yeah.
It's good, isn't it? I mean, if you've got kids, they're the natural thing. Because the thing about kids is you want to have photos like these anyway, because fundamentally they don't stand still. So it's nice to have this. And then, you know, and it's just this little tiny memory that you've got on the lock screen. And of course it works for certain kinds of, natural events, like their demo is a waterfall, and it's actually brilliant for that. So there are lots of uses for it. I mean, it is ultimately a bit of a silly gimmick in some ways, because, you know, it's not just a photo, but at the same time, anything that, you know, makes your memories slightly more vivid in terms of what you've got stored on your phone, at least, is kind of cool, isn't it?
I agree entirely, and I'm really quite impressed with that. I hadn't even thought about it.
Yeah,
but yeah,
it's nice.
All right, so that's live photo. 4K video. The quality is excellent. I used it at a wedding, and it's very, very good. The one bonus about using the 4K video, even though you haven't got a 4K screen on the phones, is that as the videos are playing back, you can actually zoom in and out of them and pan around them as if it was a large photograph.
And that's actually new, isn't it? You haven't been able to do that before.
That's new. That's a new feature. And it's something that could be replicated in software, so I'm hoping that it's supported on older phones, although obviously you need the newer ones to capture the 4K in the first place. But being able to do that is quite cool if you're making a video of a scene that isn't moving too much and you just want to zoom in on individual parts. There's so much extra resolution there now that you are actually able to zoom in there. So that's quite a neat feature. And generally, I find the phone does feel a little snappier. I was using the 6 Plus before now, and it certainly isn't sluggish, but just, I think combined with maybe some of the changes in iOS 9, the transition, the unlock, as you mentioned, things just feel very, very snappy. There's no waiting for anything, and that always does feel like it's the case with every iPhone release, and yet somehow it ends up feeling faster somehow. I'm not quite sure what that's about, but
yeah,
I noticed that.
The only concerns, I mean, we should do some things. The batteries are much smaller, aren't they, now in these two phones? And I think they've compensated slightly for that with the A9 processor, which is a bit more power efficient. But I've yet to really explore the battery life, so I don't know how that's going to turn out. You have, of course.
I have. I mean, let me think about this. I woke up at 7 a.m. this morning, and we're recording this at 9 p.m. I've used my phone, I would say, an average amount throughout the day, quite a bit of gaming on the commute and emails, podcasts, things like that. And I'm on 22% remaining.
That's pretty good.
And it's 9 p.m. So I am certainly getting through a full day, and I've done quite a lot. I've used probably half the apps on my home screen throughout today at some point, including some fairly heavy some fairly heavy live photo exploration before we started recording as well.
And we've both gone, haven't we, from pluses down to regulars.
Yeah.
So we're both compensating mentally for the fact that we do have smaller batteries. So obviously I haven't had a full day yet, and today I've been setting this thing up. And that is, you know, that whole iCloud syncing thing really does hammer the battery like you wouldn't believe. So once I've charged it tonight and use it tomorrow, I'll have a bit of a clearer picture. But yeah, it's interesting.
Well, let's cut it there. Let us know your thoughts of the new iPhones. A, these are the key points that we're keen to answer here. Number one, are you getting one of these phones, the iPhone 6, S, is this going to be your first iPhone? If so, what is it about this model that has persuaded you to take that leap? Number two, are you upgrading from a 6 to the 6 Plus? In fact, were you planning on doing before you heard the show, and are you definitely doing so or not doing so now? And thirdly, do you like what's been announced, but you've decided that it's not for you and there's not enough? Or any other reason, but yeah. There are three that I think are probably quite interesting.
Well, also, is anyone jumping? Is anyone going to Android at the moment? Because it's an interesting question. I mean, in fact, Apple's just made it very, very easy to switch from Android to iPhone. So it would be quite interesting to see, if anyone's going the other way. But I mean, this is a strong release for Apple.
I think it's one of the strongest releases in the S line that they've had. I think the 3GS was pretty significant.
That was very quick, wasn't it?
It was very quick, and it introduced new sensors into the device as well. It's the first one that had the digital compass and things. So that was very, very significant. And, you know, I don't want to discount Siri and Touch ID too heavily, but I have to say, I think this is the most significant in terms of what I use on a daily basis and would miss since the 3GS. So let us know, podcast@natelangson.com, or obviously tweet us @textmessagepod. We don't point that out enough, but we do have that account and we do look for mentions there. Now let's get into a bit of feedback that we've had over the last week or so, and we've picked three that we want to get to. And the first I'm going to read is one that is a response to a very specific question we asked a few weeks ago, staying on the Apple front. This is from Mark, and first he opens by being very complimentary of the show and that he's been listening to our podcasts for a while. So thank you very much, Mark. So he is somebody who is switching from an iPad Air to the iPad Pro. We asked for some people to give us reasons why they were thinking of that, and he's given us three in quite a lot of detail. Number one, since buying an iPhone 6 Plus last year, he's found that his iPad Air languished unused because the bigger phone was too easy to use for everything else. So he only really is using the iPad now for reading magazines and watching movies when traveling. The second thing is screen size, which I'm guessing relates to the first point as well. But that's obviously a big deal. And he says he works. Also, in another life, I work as a musician and use my iPad for lyrics, sheet music when performing. The extra screen space will help his eyes when performing in dark rooms. So that's another reason he wants the iPad Pro. And the third reason to switch from the Air to the Pro is power. Twice as much as the iPad Air 2 and the ability to multitask with picture-in-picture, all with less weight than my MacBook. So he's generally impressed with that, but it's all about screen size and power. He hasn't mentioned the Apple Pencil there. Couple of downsides, he says. It seems I missed opportunity to use the Pro moniker and not include some way of accessing an external non-cloud-based storage system. Maybe Lightning to USB-C connector will solve this in future, but it would have been a killer feature to unveil at last week's keynote. I would agree with that. He also suggests that iPad Plus would have been more accurate and, to be fair, would also be in keeping with the iPhone branding. He pointed out a couple of other things, but I thought they were really solid reasons. I think particularly the musician aspect, because that to me feels like a much more pro use, something where the bigger screen has a massive benefit. I mean, you could, of course, Mark, save yourself £1,000 and move your head closer to the iPad Air. I don't want to be the guy that points that out. But I feel I have to a certain extent, because it is an expensive product. You haven't bought it yet. You could still save some time.
There is that.
Now, we have an email here from Kate. Do you want to take this one in?
Yes, I can do, yes. Kate says, just a thought, is the buy five Kindle tablets, get one free, not aimed at schools and libraries rather than large families? Seems like it could be a good way of getting more children reading, especially from poor backgrounds who can't afford tablets. I don't think ads would be much of an issue in a public setting like that, and the price would be a primary factor in deciding to buy a load of them. That's an interesting point, isn't it? I sort of get the impression that they want to sell a lot of them. And I think one of the good things about Amazon is obviously stuff is cheap. And one of the reasons it's cheap is that they base that on moving a lot of other stuff. So you become more into the Amazon ecosystem and you spend a lot more money in it. So I think really that their whole tablet strategy is about making sure people buy more stuff on Amazon. And I think that's why it's probably aimed at families. But yeah, actually, it's a really good idea for schools where the iPad is dominant. Because I can tell you that because I've got a kid at school, and the iPad is just the de facto product. This actually makes a lot of sense because obviously it's simple, cheap, and it will give the kids a lot of what they would get with an iPad. So it's an interesting point.
I think that is a very interesting point. The one question I would have about schools is whether having ads on these devices would actually be in breach of some kind of law against advertising to children.
Interesting
or
question.
Privacy. Not that I think that's a major issue, because I do think that the bigger deal here is buying 5 tablets and getting one for free. If you've got, say, 30 children in a school, one of these costs £50 and you get 4 for free by buying 20, let's say, you know, that's saving you £200 per classroom, which on current school budgets is not to be sneezed at.
Yeah.
Kate says, P.S. Someone I went to school with posted a Facebook status yesterday announcing his separation from his wife and received 0 likes but a load of comments. Perfect use of a dislike button.
Yeah, and I understand that the dislike button is probably going to work. It's going to be a toggle, so you can't have like and dislike on a post, I think, is what... I don't know that for sure, but I was talking about it the weekend, and I think the idea is that it would be... In order to keep it so that people aren't just disliking things and being, you know, arseholes about it, I think the point of the dislike button is that if I post, a story about, you know, this guy's been caught being cruel to animals or something, I think the idea is that I would then opt to switch the like for a dislike, enabling people to leave their immediate feedback without making it look like they like animal cruelty. You know what I'm driving at, don't you? So we remain to see how that pans out, but that would make more sense, wouldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you, Kate, for that email as well. We've got one more that we're going to get to from Ronnie, who wrote in to thank us for the show and for having a British take on technology. You're very welcome, Ronnie. And also, he wanted to comment on the private browsing and the ad blocking feature introduced recently on iOS and also, of course, has been in place for some time on Android. He says, I use and have used for some time Ghostery for my browsing in Firefox on desktops and notebooks. As you are Ian rightly stated, it's difficult to go back to no block. That's why I haven't tried Microsoft's Edge browser in Windows 10 that much. It's why I don't use much mobile web. And frankly, that's one reason why I cancelled my cable TV. As a side effect, pages become clean. There were no sudden sounds. A lot of pesky comments were also blocked. YouTube is great with blocking. This is by far the superior web experience. Why should I ever whitelist anything? To me, Ronnie continues, this is where sites must innovate and be smart. I also think the software itself should inform users that they should whitelist known sites they want to support. Already, when you install it, you're informed about the moral aspect. I agree. I think, if anything, that's possibly the bit I agree with the most out of Ronnie's points, which is that maybe the ad blockers should be taking a heavier stance on, you know, we're blocking this because there are too many sites out there that have horrible, obnoxious, privacy invading, battery hogging, memory cramming, happiness destroying adverts on their sites. And they are the ones that probably should be taught a little lesson by being blocked, perhaps. But there are many, many sites out there. And I say this as someone who both uses ad blockers, but also does frequently whitelist many, many sites. There are sites out there that need to display ads, and their ads are fairly harmless. And certainly, if you're blocking them all and having no whitelist option, then you're not even giving the sites who are making an effort an opportunity to win your custom, if you want, for want of a better word, back. And I do agree.
I think that's my point, really. It was really that once someone installs an ad block, it reduces the ads to zero, and there's very little reason for them to turn that off or whitelist a site, no matter how much they like it. As an aside, I disabled my ad block after we recorded our show, and I've left it off as a sort of, you know, sort of lead by example kind of thing. And
would you like to know an interesting fact?
Yes,
Ian?
Go on.
So did I.
Oh, did you really? Interesting. Yeah. And I have found the internet to be a much more unpleasant place ever since.
Yeah.
But I guess that's the way things get paid for, isn't it? I've noticed a lot with YouTube. For example, I've now started getting mid-roll adverts on video, which Adblock seems to take care of. It's only happened a couple of times. But also, you sort of forget how good Adblock is at removing video ads. And so YouTube has become a lot more annoying. But, you know, I mean, again, there are people who make their living out of YouTube, and that's the way they earn their salaries. And I kind of feel a bit cruel, like, take it away from it, especially when I enjoy the content so much, you know, that I've been investing a lot of time in watching YouTube stuff recently for a variety of different reasons, and it's good, and it's mostly free, and, you know, that should be rewarded, shouldn't it?
It should. Well, if you have robbed any children from their live streaming income, then do let us know your reasons for not caring as much as Ian does. podcast@natelangston.com. Are you a child feeling robbed? Also let us know. We'll get your message out to those tired old crooks like Ian who are stealing your cash.
Well, no, I'm not stealing anything. I've got my ad block off now.
Well, you in debt at least, mate. You're in debt.
Yeah.
But either way, whatever your stance on the issue, podcast@natelangston.com is where you can send your feedback. And I must point out, we are approaching 100 five-star reviews in iTunes. And that's just in the UK store. I'm not even counting here when I looked earlier on today, the many other countries that I know we have people listening in, such as I know Luke, our Netherlands ambassador, has left his great reviews over there. And I know we've got a bunch in Ireland. Recently had some great feedback from some fans, if you like, in Ireland who've left some great reviews. So this is amazing. Probably if we include all the countries, we're well over 100 by now. But in terms of the review currency that we're looking at on a daily basis, the UK iTunes store is where we would love you to leave reviews the most, and certainly where you have been doing. So incredibly grateful for all those, because I've said this before and I say it again, leaving a five-star review in iTunes and a little comment or telling a friend or a colleague is more use to us, and we're more grateful than if you gave us a PayPal donation or money through the door or anything like that at this point, because, you know, that's what's getting us noticed. That's what's keeping us motivated about doing the show, is seeing these reviews, because it helps us get noticed in the store, and that directly helps us get more listeners, and that in itself helps us keep the momentum up in giving over 2 or 3 hours of our week to do the show. So thank you ever so much to all of those people who've done it so far, and hopefully see some more over the coming weeks. But in order to get involved, you have to send email to podcast@natelangston.com, and we have to wait a week to record another show.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets. Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.